I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court finished up its term after releasing a number of controversial and consequential decisions this year, including its 6-3 ruling overturning Roe v. Wade, sending the issue of abortion to the states. Yesterday was also historic for the court and for the country, with the swearing in of Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first Black woman to serve on the highest court. Here's retiring Associate Justice Stephen Breyer, whom Jackson clerked for 20 years ago, administering the judicial oath.
I, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
I, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will administer justice.
That I will administer justice.
Without respect to persons.
Without respect to persons.
And do equal right.
And do equal right.
To the poor and to the rich.
To the poor and to the rich.
And that I will faithfully and impartially.
And that I will faithfully and impartially.
Discharge and perform.
Discharge and perform.
All the duties.
All the duties.
Incumbent upon me.
Incumbent upon me.
As an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
As an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Under the Constitution.
Under the Constitution.
And laws of the United States.
And laws of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
And now, on behalf of all of the members of the court, I am pleased to welcome Justice Jackson to the court and to our common calling.
The court ruled on a number of important issues besides abortion this year, guns, the EPA, school prayer, immigration, to name just a few. This session also saw the growing power and influence of the conservatives on the court, three of whom are Trump appointees. The court's reputation has taken a hit. A new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll found that just 30% of Americans said they had a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court. We have two guests who have joined us for the hour. Mark Joseph Stern is senior writer covering the courts and the law for Slate. Mark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
You're very welcome. And joining us by Skype is Lisa Tucker. She's associate professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. And Lisa Tucker, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Well, Lisa, let me begin with you and begin with that historic day yesterday, the swearing in of Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first Black woman to serve on the nation's highest court. She is a friend of yours. Tell us what we need to know about her.
Well, yes, I'll start off by saying that Ketanji and I have been friends for many, many years. We went to law school together, but became close friends a few years after law school. And I have always thought that Ketanji had the best judgment of anyone I know, even before she became a judge at the trial level. My husband of 4 years likes to tell the story that after we'd been dating for a few months, I told him he needed to meet a friend of mine. And that was really because I needed Ketanji to assess what did she think of this guy? And luckily, she gave him the thumbs up. But she is going to be magnificent on this court. I think that the American public saw how intelligent and how reasoned and how calm she can be, how she really responds to questions in a thinking way and not getting emotional about things. And I think that was really hard to do in the Senate confirmation hearings. And I was sitting right behind her during those hearings. And for me, it was hard to stay calm watching her do that, even as she was really being railed at by many of the Republicans. I think that people can see that she really has a great judicial temperament. And beyond that, I don't think that the public has really gotten to know her yet in all the other ways that she's going to contribute. Beyond contributing on the court, we know that many of the justices, almost all of them, work significantly with the public, giving talks, talking to kids, writing books. And I think as the public gets to know her as a human being who isn't just, you know, sitting there in the most important hearing of her life, they're going to find out how funny she is and how witty and how she tells great stories and she relates so well to children. I couldn't be more excited about this.
Well, Mark, let me turn to you and ask you a slightly different question, but how do you see her role on the court. The assumption is that she will side with the liberals. I don't know if that's going to be true or not. But how do you see her as the newest member of the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I do think that she will generally sit on the left flank of the court. But of course, that is a small block at this stage, just three justices. And this swap does not alter the ideological balance of the court. I do think that she will be more progressive and more outspoken than Justice Breyer was on a number of issues, perhaps most importantly, criminal justice. You know, for all of his strengths, Justice Breyer sometimes did have a blind spot when it comes to police practices and the rights of criminal defendants. This is something that Justice Sotomayor and to a lesser degree, Justice Kagan are very attuned to. And so I think that Justice Jackson, feels so good to say those words now, will really be able to shore up that three-justice block and make an impact on the country, if not on the court's own decisions.
Well, and I don't, in fact, Lisa was our guest when we were talking about the confirmation hearing for Ketanji Brown Jackson. But if I can go back to you, Mark, I think there are some questions now that are raised about confirmation hearings, not just for her, but for a lot of the justices, about just how willing they are to be honest, if I can use that word, to talk about, you know, stare decisis, about precedents. Should we begin to sort of think differently, Mark, about what this confirmation process for the U.S. Supreme Court is all about?
I certainly think that the current process is a mess because the White House, in both Democratic and Republican hands, trains nominees to speak from pretty much the same script, to provide these very broad platitudes without committing to any particular position, and to just maintain as much latitude as possible to grow and develop and change on the bench. There may be some argument for that, but it does make for some, I think, questionable viewing, especially when that justice reaches the bench and starts doing things that look very different from what they said they would do during their hearings. The most obvious example is what Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett said about Roe versus Wade during their hearings and then said when they were on the bench and in their decisions. I think Justice Jackson was more forthcoming about her views than any of Trump's nominees. I think she provided significantly more substance, but I still think that the whole thing is a bit of an empty spectacle and more of an opportunity for senators to grandstand than to really interrogate nominees. And that does a grave disservice to the country.
Here's a related question. In fact, from one of our listeners, Lisa, this is from Stu. He says, people are jailed for minor offenses. Why is there no penalty for lying at your Supreme Court confirmation hearing? Do you see it as lying or just sort of ducking and covering?
Yeah, well, I mean, we certainly could get into whether people can be liable for things they say in those hearings. But yes, there is a ducking and covering and very careful language. For example, if I'm right, and Mark, correct me if I'm not, Justice Barrett said during her hearings, yes, Roe is settled law, and I would treat it as precedent the way that we treat all other precedent. Well, you know, in Dobbs, we did see the court deconstruct how do we treat precedent. Well, there's a several-step process in deciding whether precedent must stand or whether it can be overruled. So there would be some question as to whether she said it's precedent, so I wouldn't touch it, or did she say it's precedent, so I would touch it, and I would just use these rules in order to do it.
I mean, that's such a dance. Mark, do you want to respond to that? And I have a related question having to do with Dobbs. Some concerns that since abortion, Roe v. Wade has been overturned, is marriage equality next, or is contraception next? Do you see that door opening up?
I do see that door opening up for sure. And of course, the majority opinion in Dobbs says, well, this doesn't affect any other ruling or precedent. This is only about abortion. But the entire logic of the opinion is that if a right was not firmly established in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, then the court simply cannot recognize and protect it. And that does not just encompass abortion. There was no right to contraception in 1868. There was no right to same-sex same-sex relationships, let alone same-sex marriage. And so I do not take any comfort in Justice Alito's assurances that this is a ticket good for one ride only, because it seems to me that unless the court is willing to be totally inconsistent and intellectually dishonest about its doctrine, that decisions like marriage equality and contraception are very much on the line now.
Do you see it that way, Lisa?
I do, and I think it's very, very scary to see what the future holds, especially given what we saw in one term about the court's willingness to really change a lot of doctrines very fast, which is very unusual. With marriage equality, I'm holding out a tiny bit of hope, and here's why. First of all, we only had marriage equality established in 2015, so 7 years ago. It would be extremely unusual for the court to reverse itself in that period of time and would be seen as crazy political for it to do it. And of course, the court is still trying to deny the politics. The other reason I see it as maybe salvageable is that so many people are now married. And what do you do with all of those people? And one of the factors that the court does look at when evaluating precedent is how entrenched in it, how entrenched is it? How much have people relied upon it? And given the millions of Americans who have married their same-sex partner, that answer to that would seem to be very entrenched and relied heavily. So I agree with Mark. These rights are heavily at risk. But hopefully we have a little bit of time.
Mark,
I say hopefully.
And I hear the hope, the question mark in your voice there, Lisa. Mark, we talk about the Roberts Court. Is this the Roberts Court? Is it the Thomas Court? Is it the Mitch McConnell Court? How do you see it?
To some degree, it really is the Brett Kavanaugh Court, because he is the median justice. I mean, it sounds so odd to say this, but he sits at the center of the court, and you could really say that Chief Justice Roberts is the fourth most liberal justice now. Of course, he's not liberal at all, but he is an institutionalist, and he does care about the legitimacy of the court, and there are some issues in which he's willing to be more incremental and take a slower pace than the five colleagues to his right. And so in a lot of the major decisions this term, Brett Kavanaugh has played a decisive role, sometimes joined by Amy Coney Barrett. So I think you could reasonably call it the Trump court, if only because Trump's three nominees are really in the driver's seat. And even if Justice Thomas or Justice Alito is writing the majority opinion, they're only doing so because two or three of those justices appointed by Trump were willing to side with them and let them steer the law in a completely new direction.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mark Joseph Stern, senior writer covering the courts and the law for Slate. Also with us, Lisa Tucker. She's associate professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. And we are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, the fact that there is a new justice, a historic event that happened yesterday, but also talking about the various rulings of this court over the last session. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call 1-888-477-9499. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Lisa Tucker and Mark Joseph Stern about the U.S. Supreme Court, some of its most consequential and controversial decisions, decisions this session. Also, what a more conservative court means for the country, means for you. Let me read a comment from Monica. And Lisa, I will put this to you. And I had mentioned in my introduction this new Marist poll that found that most Americans, 58% of Americans, saying they didn't have very much or no confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court. Monica asks, please discuss lifetime appointments versus specific tenure in the U.S. court versus other countries. She also goes on to say that that the Supreme Court is not some kind of God representative on earth. These are biased people. Has the court taken a hit reputation-wise?
Oh, the court has definitely taken a hit reputation-wise. And, you know, I think going back to something Mark was saying before the break, that we could call this the Trump court. You know, there's that expression that when somebody tells you who they are, believe them. And Trump told us over and over and over again that his primary goal was to nominate justices who would overrule Roe and who would be very, very conservative along the lines of the far right portion of the Republican Party. And that's exactly what he did. Now, for many people, that might be a great thing. But I think that in looking at the decisions of this term, and, you know, the court only heard like 60, 65 cases this term, and yet look at all the enormous changes in the law, and also the attitude and the language that the court used in doing so. Justice Alito, for example, saying, you know, that the courts before had been egregiously wrong about Roe, and using very sort of smug and sarcastic language. And then some of the liberals almost screaming in dissent, saying, you know, the court is taking on roles that it has never taken on. And who are we to say this? Much like Monica says, you know, these are not the Pope, right? These are biased individuals. They're not getting their word from God. And so I think the public is right to say, what exactly is going on here? And after January 6th, I think that we have a real concern that what's going to happen with our Constitution, and how is the Constitution going to stay in effect if January 6th was just an audition? What will happen with the court and the Constitution after that?
Mark, let me quote you, and this is something that you wrote in Slate today, and this is looking back over a number of key decisions that the court made. You write, the constitutional right to abortion, gone. State's ability to limit guns in public, gone. Tribal sovereignty against state intrusion, gone. Effective constraints around separation of church and state, gone. The bar on prayer in public schools, gone. Effective enforcement of Miranda warnings, gone. The ability to sue violent border agents, gone. The Environmental Protection Agency's authority to regulate greenhouse gases at power plants, gone. When you pull all that together, what is the court doing?
The court is beginning in earnest a conservative revolution, of which this term was just the opening act. You know, it's easy to look at some of these decisions and see them as the grand finale of decades of struggle within the conservative legal movement, you know, to topple Roe, to topple separation of church and state, to topple Miranda. But this court is in a hurry to move past that first phase of overruling all of these old precedents that it despises, so that it can press forward and create new law and sort of drag the country in the direction that it believes the Constitution demands, which means more religion in the public square and in schools, fewer rights for criminal defendants, fewer privacy rights and rights of bodily autonomy. You know, the list goes on. And I just think it's so important to remember that each of the decisions that you just alluded to lays the groundwork for a future case that can take it even further than the court has already gone. So I discourage people from looking at this as a curtain closing on anything. This is really, truly just the opening act.
Again, Lisa, how do you see that?
Oh, I, you know, Mark is one of the great voices of our time talking about the Supreme Court. And I couldn't agree with him more. I didn't read your article this morning, Mark, but in prepping for this show, I went back and read a bunch of your ones over the last couple of weeks. And hearing Marty read, you know, gone, 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 it's profound. It's powerful. And, you know, people around the country have been saying for 6 years now, 7 years now, when are people going to wake up and realize that, no, this isn't stopping. We are rolling forward at a pace that we cannot control. And given, you know, some of the issues that we have with voting in this country and the way the court seems to want to treat that, we could be having even more as time goes on. All these things about get out and vote, it's super important. But if voting rights continue to be restricted the way we've seen them being and the way they're projected to be, boy, there's nothing American public can do. Do you agree, Mark?
Yeah, do you agree, Mark? Go ahead.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, as I was listening to that list, I was just thinking of all the things I left out, including two decisions on the shadow docket, which is this kind of sidetrack that the court uses in cases where it hasn't heard oral arguments, it hasn't received full briefings. But the court has effectively overturned the Voting Rights Act's ban on racial gerrymandering in a number of decisions this term, including one that was handed down on Wednesday without any opinion for the court. And so states like Louisiana and Alabama that have large black voting populations are seeing representation for black voters just plummet in these new congressional maps. And I just think that goes to Lisa's point that at a certain stage, you cannot vote your way out of the problem. When the government has been so effective at diluting the power of your ballot, at preventing your voice from carrying the day in an election, you can't just turn to regular democratic means to remedy the problem. There has to be a more sweeping solution.
Well, Lisa, and I'm thinking of a couple of Roe, obviously, that the New York gun law that the court ruled on, basically allowing open carry in the state of New York against what New York wanted. These are, if you believe the polls, rather unpopular decisions by the court. Does that matter? I mean, if the court is upholding rights and laws that few people believe in, does that affect the legitimacy of the court?
It absolutely affects the legitimacy of the court. And one conventional wisdom that we used to be able to spout for a long time, and Mark and I have both been following the court for a long time, for our entire careers, one bit of conventional wisdom that you used to be able to trot out was, even though the court says it's not political, and even though people want to say it's not political, the court doesn't sway very far from public opinion. And we have seen that completely undone this term. And I want to emphasize again what Mark said and what I said, that the pace at which they're doing it is absolutely unprecedented. You know, many historians of the Supreme Court remember the Warren era, when Earl Warren was Chief Justice for about 16 years. And during his time, many of these rights that we're discussing today were first established, but they weren't established in one term, in one year. It took almost two decades to bring some of these about, and some of them still continued to be established after his conclusion of his duties as Chief Justice. So here we are seeing everything overruled, diminished, or extended in ways. For example, the gun rights and the right that them saying that, you know, you shouldn't have to get a special license. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that you need to have any special need to carry a gun. So you can just carry a gun. And especially in the wake of these mass shootings that we've had in the United States in the last couple of years, it shows that the court really doesn't care about public opinion. I mean, imagine we had the situation in Texas with the school kids, and what was it, a few days later, a week later, that the court said, yeah, but we're going to give you more gun rights?
Yeah.
They don't care, and it's scary to watch.
Let me toss something else out, and Mark, I'll toss this to you. The court said, I believe yesterday, that they're going to rule on a case involving state legislatures and whether they have the sole power over over election rules, whether state Supreme Courts, for instance, can get involved in election rules, as what happened here in Pennsylvania back in 2020. But do you see this? I mean, we don't know how the court is going to rule on this, but the fact that they're taking the case, is that significant?
It's incredibly significant and ominous, and I consider this to be one of the most important democracy-related cases in the history of the Supreme Court. This case involves a theory that was too radical for the majority in Bush v. Gore, that has long been considered a kind of backwater on the fringe right, but over the last decade or so has surged to prominence within the conservative legal movement, that state legislatures, most of which are gerrymandered along partisan and racial lines, lines and controlled by Republicans, have near unlimited authority over federal elections so that they can set the voting rules, they can gerrymander to their heart's content, and no state court or potentially even state official or election board can stand in their way, which would mean that the many state constitutional limits on voter suppression that exist in places like Pennsylvania and North Carolina are null and void. That would be a blank check to these Republican gerrymandered legislatures to suppress Democratic votes as ruthlessly as possible, and potentially even to appoint electors in the Electoral College to the losing candidate in a presidential race.
That is truly frightening. Now, go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I absolutely agree with Mark, and I want to take it one step further. There are two really important aspects to this, and one is that it's self-perpetuating. So, for example, if Republicans controlled the legislature in a particular state, if only the legislature can make election rules, then they can make election rules that would favor Republicans, leading to a greater Republican majority. Of course, it would work the other way around with Democrats as well.
Sure.
But the other thing I think we need to think about is something that every listener learned in third grade social studies, which is the concept of checks and balances, and that the framers intended for our Constitution to give power, co-equal power, to each of the three branches. And if this is, if the court decides that yes, that this independent state legislature theory is the right one, what this means is that the executive branch doesn't have any power, the judicial branch doesn't have any power in these state legislatures, and therefore this, you know, checks and balances is the rule of the land everywhere except in elections. And elections are the only way that the American public can speak.
I am shaking here as I listen to both of you describe this case that will be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. Mark, let me toss something else out, because the court did make a number of rulings involving religion. One, Kennedy v. Bremerton School District, they ruled 6-3. This had to do with a football coach at a public high school. He now has the constitutional right to lead prayer on the 50-yard line. I believe it's after games. But what do we need to know about this, and what's the significance of the court ruling?
So this is another example of the court using the free exercise and free speech clauses of the First Amendment to dramatically roll back the Establishment Clause, which formerly guaranteed the separation of church and state. So since the early 1960s, the court has severely limited public school officials' ability to engage in overt sectarian prayer on the grounds that doing so could convey an endorsement of religion to students and could coerce students into practicing a religion that they don't support in a public school setting. But in this case, the court said that this football coach did not violate the separation of church and state by engaging in these large prayer circles in the middle of his job duties while still in uniform with his own students and teammates. And in fact, that he has a free speech and free exercise right to engage in this prayer. And that decision will be used by many teachers and other public school officials to assert a newfound right to pray at school in a way that is subtly or not so subtly coercive of students, conveying the message that if they do not join in, that they may be disfavored by the teacher. You know, in this very case, we have a testimony from students and their parents that they felt they would not get equal playing time on the field if they didn't join these prayer circles, that even though they weren't Christian, they felt coerced into supporting this prayer and participating in it because they didn't want the coach to kick them off the team or ostracize them. And that, I fear, is now going to play out in public schools across the country in settings that go far beyond just sports, because the court has granted this very broad and very novel right of school officials to engage in this kind of overt religious exercise while on the job.
Lisa, if this coach had just wanted to pray privately and quietly rather than leading his players in prayer, and the court said, would that raise other issues, or is it the leading the prayer that's potentially problematic?
Well, in fact, you know, the the school board asked the coach, please go and do this privately. Like, we have no problem with you praying. We have problem with you doing it on the 50-yard line with the players and, you know, and making a big production out of it. And Mark, you've written a lot about how, you know, they say it was private and that it was quiet and that it was quick. And yet there's photographic evidence showing the opposite. And I think this also points out to us how divided this court is. The court has, you know, always had the public image as, you know, we are one court, even though we're nine individuals, we're one court and we're very collegial. But Justice Sotomayor actually accuses the majority of lying in her dissent. She says, to the degree that the court portrays petitioners' prayers as private and quiet, it misconstrues the facts and the court ignores it. Calling your colleagues liars is a very, very big deal.
Well, indeed. And I wonder, Mark, about what clout, if any, the dissenting, the minority on this U.S. Supreme Court, are they just relegated to the sidelines or do they have a role to play?
Well, of course, when it comes to the bottom line, there's not much they can do when five or six justices want to manipulate the facts to reach their desired conclusion. But I do think that Justice Sotomayor's dissent in this case about school prayer is uniquely and unusually powerful because, as Lisa indicated, you know, she not only called out the majority for lying, she included photographic evidence that directly refutes the majority's claim about the facts in this case. And I mean, it's anecdotal, but I did see a lot of people who maybe only loosely follow the Supreme Court see those photos and react and say, how could this be deemed quiet, private prayer by a majority? And I think that there is something powerfully disturbing to realize that a majority of the court is willing to lie, to fully bend or rewrite the facts to serve its broader legal goals, and that does a great deal to undermine public confidence in the legitimacy of this institution.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mark Joseph Stern, senior writer covering courts and the law for Slate. Also with us, Lisa Tucker, associate professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. We are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, their various decisions this session, and as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Lisa Tucker and Mark Joseph Stern about the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's a comment from Mike. He says, this administration, talking about the Biden administration, is overreaching. We have three equal branches of government, and the judicial is supposed to be the referee. The current court is doing their job. This is the way it's supposed to work. So there is no reason to be upset except for the fact that it doesn't align with someone's opinion. Lisa, let me give you a chance to respond to Mike. He's saying the court is doing its job.
Yeah. So certainly the court's job is to review the acts of the administrative agencies and the executive branch, to review state legislatures, to interpret statutes, not state legislatures, excuse me, usually the federal legislature, sometimes states. But overall, I think the point about the administration overreaching is an important one, because remember how long it takes for a case to get to the United States Supreme Court. So while a couple of these cases do have to do directly with things the Biden administration has done, many, many of them do not. And in fact, yesterday when the court decided a case about the return to Mexico immigration policy, they actually found in favor of the Biden administration. And so, yes, the court is doing what it is charged with doing, but it seems to be doing so in a way that is extremely ideological rather than neutral, as it's charged to do.
I mean, Mark, could it also be argued that that Congress isn't doing its job and therefore allows the court to step in?
That is certainly part of it. In our system, power tends to flow from the branches that don't exercise it to the branches that do. And the Supreme Court sees an opportunity in cases like the EPA decision yesterday to block a regulation and say, oh, well, you know, Congress can just pass a law if it wants to do this, knowing full well that Congress will probably never pass that law. But I would also add, we were discussing checks and balances earlier. Of course, you know, the president can veto legislation from Congress. Congress can pull funding from some executive program. But we currently impose essentially no checks on the Supreme Court. Congress has not overruled a Supreme Court decision in many years, and it cannot overrule the court's constitutional decisions. Meanwhile, the court is dramatically scaling back the power of states to do things like regulate guns in public. And we're told that there's basically nothing we can do about it, that we simply have to step back and allow the court to issue the last word on virtually every major policy question of the day. And I'd just like to point out that there's really no other country that operates in this way. There's no other country that grants life tenure to its top court justices and allows them to operate without any accountability. And that strikes me as a bit of a problem.
Well, let me pick up on that. I scribbled the word term limits. Lisa, let me turn to you. These are lifetime appointments. Is there an argument to be made that give them a dozen years or 18 years or, you know, some limited term on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, and I definitely think we should talk about that. May I add one thing to what Mark said, and that is that there are no limits, including ethical limits, that all other judges in the United States are governed by a code of ethics, and the Supreme Court is not. This has been in the news hugely with the Thomases recently, and may also be a reason why confidence in the court is disintegrating. But as to term limits, probably the most popular visible proposal for term limits has been for 18-year terms. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think that that's a great idea. The problem is, of course, that with the country split the way it is, virtually 50-50, it is hard to understand how any constitutional amendment could ever get passed and ratified by the states. And so when we talk about these ideas, they're great ideas, but in our current country, in the current political climate, it just seems like it's impossible to make that happen. And you know, many changes have been made. They're talking about changing the filibuster right now. But, you know, to confirm Supreme Court justices, until very, very recently, you needed 2/3 vote. You needed like 66 votes or something, or 60 votes. And now you only require a simple majority. But think about all the justices who have been confirmed in the last several years with just that simple majority. We would have had all of these seats vacant if the rules hadn't changed, because of the very, very stark divisions with, you know, almost 50-50 in the Senate, for example.
Mark, let me pick up on another case, but related to Ginni Thomas and Clarence Thomas. This is Trump v. Thompson, and the court ruled 8-1 that former President Donald Trump could not block the release of White House records to the January 6th House Committee, and Thomas was the only one who dissented, who essentially sided with Donald Trump. And now we know that his wife was working with Mark Meadows and other people to try to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Does that raise questions about the court?
It absolutely does. And I'll just toss in that Ginni Thomas's theory that she was pushing to state legislators, to Mark Meadows and others, was this independent state legislature theory that we were discussing earlier, that state legislatures can overthrow the will of the people and appoint electors all their own. So while Ginni Thomas was advocating for this theory in the political branches, Clarence Thomas was advocating for it to become the law of the land on the court. And that kind of direct conflict of interest does more than a critic like I could ever do to undermine the public confidence in this institution. But, you know, when folks ask me, what can we do about this? The answer is essentially nothing. Even if Congress passed an ethical code for the justices, which I don't think it will do because Republicans are adamantly against it, there's really no enforcement mechanism. The only enforcement mechanism to remove a justice is impeachment in the House and a vote of removal in the Senate, which is simply never going to happen. And so I think it's very disturbing for average Americans to look at this court to see that conflict of interest, that overlap, and what I view as an image of corruption in Ginni and Clarence Thomas's work together, and to realize that there's nothing they or anybody else can really practically do to force Thomas to recuse from these cases that directly implicate his wife.
Even Chief Justice John Roberts, Lisa?
Oh my gosh, you read my mind from afar, Marty. So, you know, I think that, you know, the chief was very vocal when he took the bench in 2005 that he really cared about the legitimacy of this institution and making sure that the American public trusted it, because the court is really the place where the rule of law plays out the most. You know, in this country, we don't have military enforcement of the law most of the time. The public follows the law because they trust the courts to do a good job, even when they disagree with the decisions. But now it seems, and Mark referred to this at the beginning of the hour, that Roberts has almost turned out to be an ally with the liberals because he's so much less conservative than the other five. You almost never see him really having a lot of respect and a lot of power granted to him by the other members of the court. You've got to think that he's sort of lost his grasp on being able to dictate things to the others. So I can see him going to Clarence Thomas and saying, hey, let's talk. But what advantage is there possibly for Clarence Thomas to say, sure, chief, no problem, I'll recuse myself? Absolutely none.
Here's an email from Drew. Do you think it's a balanced take you're getting from two liberal guests? And I have to say, we didn't pick our guests because we think of them as liberal. We think of them as very thoughtful analyzers of our U.S. Supreme Court. But Drew goes on to say, I'm really curious if your guests think there's any legal merit to conservative decisions. Drew saying there is. And Mark, let me toss that to you.
Well, you know, I think that you could certainly mount a defense of individual decisions from this term on their own merits. You could mount an intellectually consistent defense of, say, the Dobbs decision, allowing states to ban abortion, which the court announced as a victory for democracy, returning the issue to the people. But, you know, just a day before that, the court issued this sweeping Second Amendment decision prohibiting states like New York and California from requiring a heightened need to carry a firearm in public. And in doing so, announced this completely novel test that requires the government to prove that any kind of gun restriction has some historical analog in 1791 or 1868, using what I consider to be extremely amateurish historical practices. And that decision had absolutely no mention of democracy or state sovereignty or all of the other values that those same justices purported to defend in Dobbs. And so, again, I think if you look at these decisions together and side by side, you see a profound inconsistency that really does not make sense as a matter of a legal principle that looks a lot more like results-driven judging, where a majority starts from its conclusion and works its way backward to fill in the legal reasoning that it feels it needs to provide.
But Lisa, I think of conservative, I mean, there are many ways you can define that word, as tradition and precedent as it applies to the U.S. Supreme Court. So maybe you could make an argument that it is conservative, you know, to hold on to some of these decisions that were made even by a liberal court.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you define judicial restraint as following precedent, and the conservatives like to say that, you know, like to associate the concept of judicial activism with the liberal branch, when in fact we've seen a huge amount of judicial activism this term, exactly in the way that Mark describes, making up new tests, abandoning precedent. But certainly,
adherence to stare decisis is a very, very conservative value, and one that many liberals share. I think that one place where we saw this very starkly was in Dobbs, where the conservatives said, the five said, well, you know, we're just going to throw it away. And Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, said, well, hold on a minute. We don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We can uphold this one statute out of Mississippi and still not overrule this very, very important and longstanding precedent. And I think that's where there is a lot of concern about the conservatives on the court and a conservative approach to judicial lawmaking right now is this tendency to want to go way farther than they have to and sort of make things up as they go along in pursuit of an agenda. At least it looks like that to a lot of people.
Let me read a couple of emails, and I do want to talk about an immigration return to Mexico policy that the court ruled on recently. But here's an email from Ron. This is not a conservative court, but a Supreme Court dominated by rightist radicals intent on fulfilling the Republican Party agenda. An email from Melissa. Ginny Thomas supported a coup. Now Clarence Thomas will be deciding on state legislative election control. An email from Patrick, we've had more than 50 years without school prayer. I am glad we are now moving back to God. Mark, let me turn to you. And the court did rule 5-4 on an immigration policy. This was a little bit complicated, but nonetheless, what did the court say? And what's the significance of what it ruled?
So the court said that the Biden administration can lawfully rescind a policy that Trump instituted called Remain in Mexico, that for the first time forced asylum seekers and refugees at the southern border to live in these tent cities filled with violent crime while they were awaiting their hearings in the U.S., rather than staying in the U.S. on their own recognizance, which has been the standard for more than a quarter century. And I want to talk about the background of this case because it's important to understand. Typically, presidents get to impose their own immigration rules and repeal their predecessors' rules. Biden tried to do that with Remain in Mexico on day one, but Republican-appointed judges in the lower courts stopped him. And in fact, a single judge, Matthew Kaczmarek, appointed by Donald Trump, issued a decision that not only required Biden to restore this Remain in Mexico policy, but ordered the administration to send officials to speak with Mexican diplomats to renegotiate the terms of the deal. Because, of course, we have no power on our own to force Mexico to keep thousands of people within its jurisdiction. This lone judge then oversaw diplomatic negotiations for more than a year, forcing government attorneys to do this under threat of sanction. And the Supreme Court let that happen by a 6-3 vote. It waited a year to issue the decision that it issued yesterday, rather than stepping in immediately and saying, this is not how our Constitution works. So even though yesterday did give a victory to the Biden administration, it was a victory that should have happened a year ago. And I think that the majority was really showing Biden who's boss by forcing him and his administration to remain under the thumb of this lone judge while this case was pending before SCOTUS.
We're almost out of time. Here is a comment from Dorothy. And Lisa, I'll put this to you. She says, I agree with everything you're saying, but I want to know how we can stop this.
Yeah, I mean, that is the million-dollar question. You know, as of right now, getting out and voting with the Supreme Court in mind, you know, it wasn't until very recently that people even really thought of the Supreme Court as an important issue in a Senate race or in a presidential race. And it so clearly is. That's what we're seeing right now. Work to uphold our Constitution. Work to get people to see how skewed things are right now and get them to the polls. Do everything you can to get people to the polls.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Lisa Tucker, as always, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She is Associate Professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law here in Philadelphia. Mark Joseph Stern is Senior Writer covering the courts and the law for Slate. Mark, thanks for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me back on.
You're very welcome. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for all those comments as well. Really, really fascinating. Thank you.